We have a quorum. I'd like to call a meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. First order of business is approving of our minutes from February 23rd. Do I have a motion to do that? Representative.
Okay. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Bogle moves the minutes. Any questions, or hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, and those minutes are adopted. We're going to hear two bills today, and we'll reverse the order, I think, if Representative Rukavina is prepared to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, very kind of Representative Banyan to let me go first, since my constituents have about a 3.5-hour drive home, and they want to beat the snowfall.
Good plan.
So thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to move your bill?
I'll move that House file. Geez, what is my House file number here? 1137 to be recommended to pass.
2213.
For possible inclusion?
Yes.
Is
that House file 22. No, it's 1137. Yeah, yes. I'm on the wrong line.
And Mr. Chair, I make a couple of oral amendments to get the bill in order. Maybe
go ahead.
Ms. Novak can help me just to change the dates in the bill to 2013 instead of 2011, and then to delete Section 2. I don't want to, I mean, I'd like to concentrate more on the mining part of this bill as opposed to the forestry and not get involved in that, since I don't know what the university is going to say when they come up here. So, with that, then, Mr. Chair, if I could move that.
Yes, please go ahead and move the amendment.
Okay. I will make that motion then to change the dates to 2013 and to delete Section 2 of the bill on page 2.
All members have that? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Go ahead. Thank you, members. Well, I'm here today to ask for your help in establishing a mining metallurgical related engineering degree at the University of Minnesota, similar to a model that's being used right now up on the Iron Range at the Mesabi Community College Iron Range Engineering Program, which you may recall the governor mentioned in his State of the State and recognized the program, and others from INSCU have also, in front of this committee, congratulated me on because of that program and the success that it's had. You know, this is a program that's going to benefit all of the people of the state of Minnesota, people in this country, I feel, students in both K-12 and the University of Minnesota system, and certainly the people of northeastern Minnesota that I represent. But before I talk about the particulars of the bill, members, I would, Mr. Chair, if I could, like to bring down Mr. Ron Alseth, who is the head of the Iron Range and Engineering Program, and Ms. Christy Nelson, who's a recent graduate, to kind of tell their stories. So if I could bring them down. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your help on that, and I will move out of the way. So Ron just identified herself. Go ahead and hand it off to Christine.
Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself. I'm not sure who's going to begin, but
I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ron Alseth, and I'm an engineering instructor at Itasca Community College and in the Iron Range Engineering Program, which is a collaboration between Minnesota State Mankato and Itasca Community College. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the Iron Range Engineering Program, about its model, and then we have one of our recent grads, Ms. Christine Nelson, who will talk a little bit about her experience in our program and where that has brought her. The history of the Iron Range Engineering Program actually didn't start here in Minnesota. It's more of a nationwide issue, and it goes back about 10 or 15 years. A call from industry, in particular the Boeing Corporation, asking for engineers who had a completely different skill set than was at that time being delivered through the education system. What was happening then was that people were spending a lot of time in classrooms being talked to in a passive learning environment and learning how to solve problems mostly with one single answer in the back of a textbook. Being a product of that system, I found the transition into engineering extremely difficult, because engineers don't work out of the back of a textbook. We don't solve single linear type problems. They're very complex, and they involve people. And we are expected to be able to communicate. We're not expected to live up to the Dilbert comic that we see in the Sunday paper. So I go back to that call from Boeing and others, and unfortunately, higher education across our country did not respond. Engineering education has not changed much. If you were to go to the university that I graduated from in this region and walk into any of the classrooms, they'd look just like they did in 1988 with some of the same teachers teaching in the same way and engineers not getting this new skill set. There were a group of people in about the year 2005 from around the country, from Stanford, Penn State, Texas A&M, Washington State University, Arizona, Arkansas, and the Military Academy at West Point, that said, we've got an idea. We've got a new way to take engineering from being passive learning and turn it into active learning. And that model was developed. And then it sat on a shelf for a while until 2009, when Representative Rukavina, through the Iron Range Higher Education Committee, found a way to fund that startup of that model. And it started as a collaboration between Mankato and Itasca on the Mesabi campus, started in January of 2010. We had our first graduates in December of this year. 12 students graduated. 11 of them are employed, all in the state of Minnesota. They are all employed as engineers, and they're making, on average, $60,000 per year. As a program like ours gets started, one of the first things people ask about is accreditation. The accrediting board is a national board called ABET. And ABET's process is that once your first graduates graduate, you can apply for accreditation. And so we did, and the process is underway. And all those people I mentioned from Stanford and Penn State, University of Missouri, Texas A&M, they're on our board. So not only did they help develop it way back, but they are currently on the board. They'll be on the Iron Range March 20th to prepare this program for its accreditation. We believe that accreditation is a matter of following the appropriate procedures, and we have a lot of evidence that our program is a solid program. There are a lot of people who, and I guess our governor is one of them, who feel that this model of active learning is the appropriate model. So in this bill that Representative Rukavina has put forward, we're looking to expand that model from general engineering to mining engineering. And we at the Iron Range Engineering Program stand by, ready to interact with all those that would come forward to deliver this bill. And that is my story of the Iron Range Engineering Program. And now we have Christine Nelson. She graduated from LaPorte High School, Itasca Community College, and now the Iron Range Engineering Program. So she is a Minnesota State Mankato graduate. Christine?
Christine, would you identify yourself for our record and then proceed?
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Christine Nelson. I'd like to take the time to talk a little bit about my experiences at Iron Range Engineering. Again, I started at Itasca Community College at their pre-engineering program. And when time came to transfer to a four-year university, I very much like hands-on things. As my mother can attest to, I did science experiments in the basement as a child. So hands-on was very much my thing. Iron Range Engineering offers this. I had a unique opportunity to have a mechanical engineering co-op at United Taconite, which is a mine located in Forbes, Minnesota. And what a mechanical engineering co-op is rather than having a three-month summer internship, it is a six-month position. So my employment would have ended last December. During this process, I had to be a student in order to graduate in December as well. So because of Iron Range Engineering's unique curriculum, I was able to use work conducted in the workplace as projects for school. And having lived being a full-time engineer and a full-time student, I can honestly say that I've never learned more in my life. Doing these things in parallel rather than in series truly is the best way to learn. And I would also have to say the more opportunities and the more different styles of engineering that we could get at this program would definitely benefit our local industries and even the nation as we become more recognized.
Thank you very much.
She's very modest because she is, and there are a number of women engineers at United Tech, and owned by Cliffs Natural Resources, I guess is the name of it now. And, you know, I told Christine on the way down, she's bossing around old guys like me, you know, so that's a pretty good job, you know, for just a recent graduate from the Iron Range Engineering Program. So with that, if there are no questions of the witnesses, Mr. Chair, I suppose I can
Ms. Nelson,
on.
do you live nearby so you could stay at home? Or
I live in Virginia, Minnesota, so okay. It's about 20 minutes just north of Forbes where the United Taconite plant is located at.
Okay. Good. Any members have questions? Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, members, what I would like to do then is I've got some handouts, I think, Mike, that you get them out to the, are they in the package? And, of course, some of you may remember, you know, our little primer on iron ore royalties in the state. I was at Mazzo, remember that from last year on the floor, and I've updated this a little bit to show you currently what's happening as far as iron ore royalties. United States Steel, in one of the handouts you have, you will notice the royalties going into the school trust, the big pink bar on the graph, and I think this handout right here that you have shows you DNR's projections for school trust, university tax forfeit lands over the next several years. As you can see, the University of Minnesota at Kiewit and Taconite right now is mining their ore to the tune of about $10.9 million over the next several years and then going to $9 million. That money is currently, as it comes into the university, going into these two smaller funds here that were established in 1993 when I changed the direction of the university's royalties. Previous to that, it would have gone into the Permian University Fund, which over the last 130 years of mining, as you can see, is about 85% of that $396 million came from iron ore and taconite royalties. And it would what would happen at the legislature prior to 84 or 5, that money would just be deducted from the appropriation that we gave the University of Minnesota. The interest on it would then be part of our appropriation to them. In 84 or 5, and I can't remember, right around there, Governor Rudy Perpich said, listen, if you take and you match that with private foundation money, we'll let you use it to endow the chairs at the University of Minnesota. It's been a very successful program. I believe with the match that was required from the private sector, that about 30%, I believe, of the chairs at the university are endowed through that program. But in 1993, I changed the flow of that money to go 50 cents on a dollar into a scholarship fund, which has become the largest scholarship at the University of Minnesota, and a research endowment at the Natural Resource and Research Institute in at Duluth and Coleraine. Members, let me tell you why I'm so hepped up on this. First of all, for the University of Minnesota, which was built on mining, to not offer a mining engineering degree anymore is kind of makes me sad, I guess. And, you know, I've tried to impress on the university the importance of mining for them because they own mineral rights as a land-grant college. They received mineral royalties or mineral rights in this state. And currently, not only are there minerals being mined at Kiewit and Taconite, but Esser Steel, which is building a taconite plant and hopefully a steel mill, has about 1,300 acres of university royalties leased. And Mesaba Nugget, which is making a new product on the Iron Range, a 96%+ pure iron nugget that can be used in mini mills or foundries, is also leasing, trying to lease university plans, but as I mentioned in this committee a couple weeks ago, we've got some environmental new issues that have arisen at the EPA and a rule that was discovered dealing with sulfide mining that is currently jeopardizing that income at Keewatin Taconite and causing problems at Musabanagat, ironically, both of whom are mining currently or trying to mine University iron ore, and we've got no one that's being trained in mining or metallurgical engineering or being taught how to solve some of these problems. So that's, you know, one of the reasons that I want a model established that's similar to the one that's being taught or being used in Virginia, that this bill creates an endowment at $25 million. The flow into the little red bar on the graph here stops at $50 million under current law. And actually that will be reached this year as Keewatin Taconite continues to mine the university's ore. So both of these funds will be over $50 million. And the law as it's written now, 100% of the money would start going into the scholarship fund. And what I'm trying to do is establish an endowment for mining, metallurgical, and giving the university a lot of leeway in setting it up or a related engineering program. And I think the time has come for us to do that, members. It's, you know, the potential in minerals in this state is unbelievable. Just in iron ore, taconite royalties, there's, you know, the DNR told me yesterday that at Esser Steel and Musabanagat, the university could be getting anywhere from $5 to $10 million a year on top of the $10 million they're currently getting at Keewatin Taconite. That's not even starting to talk about copper, nickel, and the other platinum group metals that are out there in the state of Minnesota that the school kids own, the university owns, etc. So I would appreciate your support on this, members. I know Dr. Robert Jones is here from the university to talk about the bill, and I know that he's really excited about it and elated to support it, but we'll see what he has to say. And then I bought a prop, too, members, because, you know, if the university says I'm springing this on them, I want you to know that I gave President Brunix a shirt, because I was trying to start rock you up on the range, you know. That's the Range University of Knowledge, by the way. And we've got on here where minds and minds explode, see? And I gave that to President Brunix about, and I think Robert got one too, about 4 years ago. So if they come up and say I'm springing this on them, no, they must have thought I was joking, but I wasn't. I've got the proof right here.
Wait, what's the tag say on there?
This one isn't made in the USA, I have to be honest. It was a rush job, but I stayed in this hemisphere. It's from Mexico.
That's good. Thank you.
I'm being honest, but this sport coat is union made in the
okay,
U.S.
Okay, all right. We have Representative Benson, I think, has a question before we get to other testifiers.
Representative Rukavina, and if you want to bring somebody else up, I know, you know, it's the build it and they will come kind of thing that's going on here, but just still looking at the market for students who would be interested in those things that, you know, we may, you know, pass the bill and you suddenly have an opportunity to have some scholarships for that and so on. I know there are other mining and metallurgical and engineering programs in other areas.
Not many.
But we have great testimony from a student. But, you know, we build this. What's the market for it? I mean, what's the interest that's been shown for these students? Because we could be allocating and separating monies out, and then we don't have near as many takers as this would might be set up for.
Thank you, Representative Benson, for reminding me of that. I gave you a handout in here that shows a little bit of research that we had done with the help of with the Iron Range Engineering Program and former Majority Leader Sertich's father, who did some consulting for us. And it shows just on the Iron Range a need of 5 to 8 mining engineers a year. But, you know, there's such a demand for mining engineers all around the country now, with, you know, this hydrofracking and everything else that's going on in oil exploration and other precious metals being looked at in other parts of the country, that I think this program would be a huge success. It's very hard, and maybe Ron can come up and testify on that. He might have some something to add to this. But a lot of these people are sought after, and maybe Christine in 4 or 5 years will have been taught enough about mining engineering that she can go on somewhere and be offered a lot more money and a better job somewhere. But there is a huge demand right now, and we're very confident that, that this program could easily train 8-10 people a year who could then go on and get placed anyway. So I did hand this out, and I'm glad you brought it to my attention because I forgot to mention it.
Good question. Any other questions?
And members, I have to tell you, it's a little cute little story, but, the first time I proposed this, the university wasn't too enamored by the directing the money, redirecting it to begin with. And so at the time, Dr. Enfante was, I think, head of the Natural Resource College at the university. And then the lobbyist, Peterson, who just retired recently, we went to Dixie's and we bantered this out, and former Senator Janicek was there. And we drew the agreement out on a placemat at Dixie's. And then the university got amnesia. So I had to photocopy the placemat and send it to them. And here is the original agreement on the placemat at Dixie's. I saved it. I found it in a file. And it shows you 50-50 going in here. And I had to remind the university, so I photocopied it. And we ended up getting the Iron Range Scholarship and the endowment at the NRI put into law. But it was not easy. And so, I don't know what we're going to hear today from the university, but the first time we redirected this money wasn't a slam dunk for us either, but now they're very pleased with the program. So.
We, Representative, probably need to hear from the university now.
I believe we do. I don't know if Robert wants to sit by me, if he wants me to get out of his way, or what, but we have a good working relationship. You right there.
Welcome, and identify yourself for the record, please.
You sit here,
Robert
to support
Jones.
Support me, and then you sit over here if you don't.
Robert Jones, University of Minnesota.
Please go ahead.
Yes. Chair Nernis, members of the committee, Representative Rukavina, the University of Minnesota has been supportive for quite some time now of efforts to expand higher education offerings on the range, including service on the Range Higher Education Committee. I've had the pleasure of serving in that role since its inception. As well, we've been very supportive of the effort that was discussed earlier in terms of the development of the Iron Range Engineering Program by offering a new Master's of Engineering degree and a Master's of Science in Engineering Management that are delivered on the range by the University of Minnesota Duluth faculty. So we have been engaged and have been very supportive and clearly recognize the need to address higher education issues on the range. So the University of Minnesota appreciates Representative Rukavina bringing this proposal forward. We are investigating the vitality of such a program because we clearly understand the need to fully understand the cost and infrastructure implications of expanding this type of offering on the range. These investigations will include, from our perspective, a need for such a professional program in the region and in the state. We've heard testimony, and we also are privy to some of the analysis that has been done so far. But we need to better understand the long-term and short-term vitality of this type of program because we're very much aware of the cyclical nature of the mining industry, and we want to better understand the employment prospects for students coming out of this program, both in terms of both short-term and long-term vitality of such a program. We also want to investigate, in the process of investigating the startup cost of such a program, including the cost of hiring new faculty to drive this new academic initiative, the cost for developing the curriculum, and also to look at any accreditation issues and concerns that may also surface. We also want to investigate the academic and programmatic offering and also take a more detailed analysis of facilities needs and the requirements for providing instruction in collaboration with Mesaba Range Community and Technical College.
We are very much concerned and want to be able to understand if there is a cohort of qualified, academically qualified students to populate this program on an ongoing basis, and to make sure that we have the coursework and facilities available so that the university can maintain a very high quality program. So again, we thank Representative Rukavina for bringing this bill forward. But until we have an answer to some of these very, very important and pressing questions, we remain neutral on the bill. However, we look forward to working with the committee and Representative Rukavina to getting these issues resolved in the next 4 to 6 weeks so that a final decision can be made and the university's perspective on this can be quite clear.
Thank you, Representative Benson.
Dr. Jones. I guess I'm under the assumption that if the university is probably always looking at market, and you know, market from the standpoint of satisfying needs, be it in engineering or the chemistry or whatever department, would this be something that if you had found 2 years ago that there was a void or a need in this area and there was a market demand for it? Is this something that you could have done on your own,
Mr. Jones?
Chair Nornes, Representative Benson, it would have been difficult for us to do it on our own, given the financial constraints that we face, and based on what we know and what other analysis has said about the potential number of students that will be interested in or available for such a program. You might imagine the cost for ramping up a new program that's remote from the campus is very, very costly. And you would have to think about the cost as it relates to the potential amount of revenue that can be generated. It's a lot of cost associated with developing a program for a relatively small but important cohort of students. And that's why we want to do the analysis so that we can get a better understanding of the cost-benefit analysis. And the biggest issue is, I think, the one that you raised earlier about sustainability over time, you know, making the investments, the startup cost of getting a program started, and then having a greater sense of assurance of the sustainability beyond, you know, the current economic situation and demand for students.
Mr. Jones, do you have an estimate on how long this might take to do that study or investigation?
Well, we have already had the analysis underway. We have benefit of some additional work that we did on behalf of the Iron Range joint study that we under Representative Rukavina's initiative a couple of years ago, so we have benefit of some of that analysis, and so we have to update some of our forecast, and we anticipate being able to get this done in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Right. Members,
Representative Rukavina?
If I could, you know, impress on the university and the committee the importance of this. When you look at those, you know, those different endowments that were created because of the, I guess, foresight of, you know, our founding fathers in this country, basically, when we became a state, we inherited lands to help public education and to help our public university. And but I can't tell you right now the importance of getting some real bright minds at the university involved in the dilemma that we're facing up in northern Minnesota. We have a standard in PCA rules that is only being applied to mining, even though there are many agricultural areas down in your area, Representative Vogel, that are violating this standard at a much higher rate than mining, but it seemed to only be specifically being applied to mining, and it's causing investments of well over in the couple of billions of dollars of private money to back off from investing in Minnesota. And I've tried to impress on the university the importance of getting, you know, proper professors or whomever to look at this, but I think to have a mining metallurgical type engineering program would be a good start in doing this. I can only imagine if Glenn Taylor or Bill Gates or somebody told the University of Minnesota over the next 10 years, we're going to give you $8, $9, $10 million a year, you'd be jumping off the roof at the new Gopher Stadium down there, Robert, and so would President Kaler. But here we got $7, $8, $9, $10 million a year coming in from Kiewit and Taconite, which corporate headquarters at U.S. Steel have told us that their investment jumping $200-300 million more dollars than they anticipate investing out there might jeopardize the whole mine. And the same with Mesabinucket. They can't get a permit from PCA to dewater the pit where the university owns the minerals in the pit. And so, you know, it's our land-grant college that, you know, should really remember who helped them in the past days with a lot of their foundations. It was a university built on mining, and I'm trying to force the issue that, you know, we should come around again and admit that when about 15 years ago, and before most of you except maybe Representative Pawlowski remember, Gene, when we went from mines to mines? Well, maybe it's time we go back to the mines, because I don't think the mines can operate without the mines operating, because all of those research materials and that come from the earth, and that's one of the points I want to make today besides this actual presentation on the importance of this degree.
Members, any other questions? Anyone else want to testify that you know of? That's okay. Then I believe we're ready for you to renew your motion, I guess,
Representative. Mr. Chair, then I don't know if you need me to renew it.
We'll lay it over.
Lay it over for possible.
House File 1137 will be laid over for possible.
And meanwhile, I will be working with Dr. Jones.
Thank you.
Thank you, members.
All right. Representative Bannion, you next. Want to move your bill, Representative Bannion?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the intention is for us to lay this over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then, in that case, let me proceed to present to you House File 2213. This is a bill that has basically two impulses that bring it. I think. Right for discussion at this time. First of all, the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 placed some instructions, some laws before bookstores, faculty, administrations of our higher education institutions that included instructions regarding textbooks. Many of those instructions concern the relationship between publishers and bookstores, publishers and faculty, publishers and institutions. As I reviewed it, I thought one area that was lacking was its ability or its instruction in terms of providing information to students. The second impulse confirmed that it was that the Minnesota State University Student Association came to me last fall with a request that I would consider possibly introducing a bill regarding textbooks. And I want to cite them as give them credit for making this a priority for their organization, for engaging in a series of discussions with me over various drafts. We looked at what had been done in other states, and the result is before you as a first draft of this bill, as best we could find on it. And let me walk you through this, and then what I'd like to do is to have a series of presenters come, including two different student groups, including MSUSA, the Minnesota, and the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition from the U of M, and then a professor who teaches at McAllister College, who's done a lot of research on textbooks. And you will see on your desk going around right now a paper that he's prepared for you to look at as background information, and I would encourage you to review it. But first, let me just address the various parts of the bill, and with it, perhaps with particular reference to staff ideas and conversations that have happened over the last week for potential improvement, so that should you decide to include 2213 within your omnibus, that we could have an improved version drafted. First of all, just noting Section 1 is an encouragement to both the University of Minnesota and private colleges to read and consider carefully the requirements in subdivisions 2, 2A, and 3 listed in Section 136F-.58, excuse me. At 1.14, it calls for the inclusion for students for the institutions to provide them with information about the textbooks that will be required and recommended for the class at the time when they are getting prepared to register for the class. Sometimes that information shows up much, much later. A student has committed to taking a class, committed to a schedule, and then finds out that the textbooks for their course are well in excess of $200. A Minskew institution, that could constitute about 20% of the cost of the course. And that might be the difference between them being able to take the course and not. So we want the information to get to them earlier. Likewise, if you'll turn to page 2 of the bill, this is what instructed me at least to suggest in lines 2.1 through 2.7 to move the dates from 30 days for notification of a final order to 45, from 15 to 30 for the bookstores to get information. We want our students to be able to have enough time to see what texts and other materials are required, and then have them search and receive frequently the materials that are desired to take the course. The materials that are listed there are start at line 2.8 and work their way down to 2.23. Just a little note on that, lines 2.11 and 2.12 have the striking because that is part of what we believe to be superseded by the federal law and therefore no longer needed, superfluous in our own language. Representatives from the publishers suggest to me that may also be true for lines 2.14 and 2.15. I would suggest that staff help me research that, be sure, determine whether that's true or not, and if so, I would suggest to the committee and to the chair that he, in putting this into the omnibus, if he chooses to do so, strike those lines. Lines 2.16 and 2.17 have proven in conversation with all concerned to be relatively problematic. They require the copyrights of three previous editions. There's language in current law, I think Representative Morrow just pointed out to me, the current law does have some statements about notifying us on previous revisions. There should be some consideration about that and some conversation that happens as well. Lastly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, Section 4, the task force, was something that in the initial discussions with MSUSA was something we thought we would want to do. It turns out that MSUSA has had conversations since then with Minskew, and there's a working group that language that they are working on to propose, I believe, in our Senate companion that may in fact get added to the Senate version of this bill tomorrow in their committee hearing on the bill. I'm agreeable to it, I should tell you, so that if that language is worked out and if both sides agree to it, I'm willing to have that. That would also, I should note, Mr. Chairman, obviate the need for a fiscal note. The fiscal note that's in your packet attaches entirely to the cost of a task force per se. I understand that if it's a working group rather than a task force, that avoids that. It also would avoid us having to travel this bill to any other committee before doing so. So I think that's I thank them for working together to try to come to that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take initial questions and then ask you to work through the list of testifiers.
Thank you for a very thorough walkthrough. Representative Morrow, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Banyan. Representative Banyan, as you know, and I just shared with you that I will be introducing a bill on another related concept. Mm-hmm. Members, OER, Oberlin Educational Resources. So we're talking about materials that would be available on the Internet. We're going to talk a little bit, I'm sure, as testifiers come up about that. Representative Banyan, I have two questions. One is on your change from 30 days to 45 days on line 2.3.
Yes.
Representative Banyan, both you and I have assigned textbooks, and I'm going to be the first to say that sometimes I don't get my order in when the bookstore would like to see it.
Yep.
And what I'm wondering is why you chose to go to from 30 to 45 days before the term commenced, especially for the fall term. And the reason I ask that is because buyback period will occur much before 45 days before the beginning of the fall term. So bookstores, college bookstores around the state, don't know what books to buy back because they're going to be used the next semester on the campus.
Yeah.
So I was wondering why you timed it to prior to the commencement of the term. Would not either time it to the buyback period on campus when professors have to choose their books, or perhaps time it to when the course schedule has to be set by a department for the next term?
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, we sound like two old chairs chatting, department chairs chatting. Look, I said it, we said it, and again, this was in discussion with Minsky. The 45 days is more an instruction related to the Minsky schedule. 45 days puts you approximately, particularly when registering for spring classes, in the period where registration would happen. We would like there to be consideration by students of the cost of the books at the point of registration. And I wasn't really thinking of buyback at all. But your language suggestion, I think, is wise regarding the timing vis-a-vis fall semester. If you have a suggestion, I think all of us would be open to that idea.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Banyan. I'm putting it out there so everyone could consider this,
sure,
and you
absolutely.
And I could talk some more. Mr. Chair, my second question is about Section 135A.25. It's not in your bill, but I did come show you. This is the,
right.
Members, the Textbook Disclosure Pricing and Access bill or statute that we passed in 2007. Representative Banyan, here's the question I have for you to consider. This is about the current edition and previous editions. I'm not so sure that having the three previous copyright editions available in any form is helpful, but under current Minnesota law, publishers have to make available to faculty and bookstores and institutions the differences between the current edition and the previous edition. What I'd like to work with you and with all the stakeholders in the room is that information doesn't necessarily get to students. So the information may be online on how the current edition and previous edition differ, but students don't necessarily know that. And if they knew that, as some students have said to me, and I'm sure they said to you, they would have bought the previous edition for $10 as opposed to the new edition for $110. So I'd like to work with you not to do the three previous copyrights, but maybe we could use the textbook disclosure language and make sure that notification, that link to a website, if you will, gets to students.
Yeah,
Representative Banyan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, happy to work with you on that. I think that would be very helpful. I think again, lines 216 and 217 for a lot of people are problematic because different information is available to different folks. You and I, as faculty, can go see what previous editions are. It's not evident that the bookstores can. It's certainly not evident that the university can get that information easily, and the bookstores have indicated that's a real hurdle to them. Let's work on that. But there is already disclosure language in law, as you point out, and we may just need to refer back to what currently exists.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we have some testifiers, I guess, that want to come forward. Beginning, I think, with Amanda Bardonner.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back. Hi.
Thank you. Chair Nornes, committee members, for the record, I'm Amanda Bernard, State Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Just wanted to thank Representative Banyan for all of the conversations that he's had with our students across the system about this legislation. As you know, textbooks and the cost of textbooks is always on the minds of students. And so we're just looking for some type of conversation to continue around that. And we really want to be innovative in the strategies that we take within the system. And really lead in the nation with what we're doing with textbooks. As Representative Bannon had alluded to, there is a draft that would change the task force to a working group. Just wanted to let you all know we're in conversation with MNSCU about that. Really, the idea of the task force was to bring all the stakeholders to the table and really talk about what are the issues, what's driving the cost of textbooks upwards, what are some ways we can reduce that, but also what are some strategic ideas that we can bring together and really think about new innovative ways to offer textbooks. Obviously, online textbooks are huge, ebooks with students, and so what pilot programs or things that we can implement, and so those are all conversations that will continue under that working group if you were to pass this. Also, just wanted to mention there were some questions about the change from the 45 days to the 30 days, and in conversations with the bookstore, actually each bookstore has their own policy and dates that the faculty are to follow as well, and so we found that this is more of a reasonable timeline, that there still might be dates that are earlier on such campuses, but that works for their process. And so I guess I would just stand for any questions if there are any on the student perspective.
Thank you for presenting. I don't see any questions at this time, so thank you. Chris, is it past it? Welcome again to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Tassett. I'm the chairman for the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and I'm here today to talk on behalf of students across the University of Minnesota system. So I'd like to come out and say that we lend our full support to this measure. We want to thank Representative Bannon and other authors for this initiative. We feel that it's very worthwhile in the interest of this being something of a financial burden to students, something that, like what was previously mentioned, is of significantly on the minds of students. We see this as a step in the right direction, essentially, to address each measure individually, to provide some personal background, I guess. I can attest to having experienced moments where I have purchased a book in preparation for class. For instance, my Calculus 2 book, bought it ahead of time, used, only to find out as I went to class that that $100 that I spent on that used book was no longer worth anything because a new version had been used and all of those problems were now out of date. And going back to the bookstore, I was met with a return value of approximately $10. So this is an issue that not only is specific to my case, but it's something that occurs very regularly. And in my role as a teaching assistant for biology over the past couple of years, I've seen a wide swath of students that come in, and a very regular question on the first day of class is, do I need the textbook or not? What does that matter? And does the one I have count for anything? So this is something that's very wide-reaching across students, and in terms of recognizing a discrepancy, putting forward transparency measures like this would be of great benefit to students. And also, in terms of developing a task force like this, I also have to commend the work on behalf of the MNSCU folks that this task force and the role that the state would play in this recognizes a significant effort and something of great need. And we acknowledge the fact that the state would throw their hat in the ring and make sure that students are accounted for in that way. And also, if I could touch on the specific language as it relates to the University of Minnesota, strictly the concept of encouragement rather than statute enforcement. Our role as student advocates and what we do with the university, we see it to be our mission to also work with the administration and actively lobby the administration on behalf of students. And I can say that one of our initiatives will be to then carry these measures forward and work towards compliance with the university administration. And that's all I have, and I would stand for questions if need be.
We have a question. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to really understand this bill, I guess, and the purpose, and I understand that students are concerned about the high cost of textbooks. That's been going on for a long time. What I'm trying to get is really how will, maybe the question to you is, what will you do to help enlighten students, help them to be better consumers? Because part of the questions that students ask or the things that students do when they buy textbooks, and maybe that information was available, but they actually didn't do diligence to get to that information. So what is your role in helping students to understand what they need to do in order to make wise choices and good decisions.
Mr. Casted?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. That's very pointed. And in some ways, to address a question on behalf of Representative Morrill, this bill, in the way that it's being presented, I think represents something that's been overlooked in the discussion regarding the textbook conversation. Publishers are largely targeted in the policies that they exercise, and statute has largely focused on the way that they engage the market and the way that they're pricing textbooks and how things are updated and their general practice. And I think that's still worthwhile to pursue, but what this bill is looking to do, and I think what something is worthwhile, is to actively look at how the university itself, the administration, is engaging students and providing that information. Something like providing a link to the information in terms of discrepancies between versions, that's something I can attest to is not readily available, and I myself have had a hard time finding. That's something I would say largely students are unaware of. And our role in terms of what we do as students with the MSLC is to actively work with the administration, propose mechanisms and means that we can best represent students. So we will be looking to frame this goal of making students more accessible, making the information about, making textbooks and their costs more accessible, and the information more transparent as to how students should be making their choices in terms of buying those things, and framing those into objective actions that can be taken on behalf of the administration.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's your expected outcome? Do you expect students will choose different sections of a class or choose a different teacher, choose to not purchase the book at the bookstore but to go online? Do you have an expected outcome that says students will actually have a reduced cost to them?
Mr.
Chair, Representative, I would say the outcome definitely is looking up. I can say in my own experience, and from this is something that's commonly discussed among students as you exchange information and decide what classes you're taking. One of the core features outside of how's the professor, what's the content like, is how relative is the textbook. And the concept of whether or not you can buy a used textbook and that's effective, or there are other resources online, or something like buying an e-book, those are things that make a significant difference, and you can be looking at paying up to 100, half the cost of the book would be definitely reasonable for almost every single class if each student was able to be effectively provided with this information. So we see if what we're defining here in our outcome comes to fruition, that students would drastically benefit from the ability to make wise decisions. At this point, in some sense, it varies from class to class, but for instance, like a calculus class or a biology class, I'm a biology major, you don't really have the option of switching to a particular class or moving to a different section. Those books kind of span the entire course. But the idea is that being able to buy a used copy and be confident that that book is going to be effective in what you do in the course will make a very significant difference.
Representative Bandian, do you have a response?
Just to clarify, Representative Poppy, on the handout for the next testifier that you should have received during our meeting today, on at the end of page 2 and the top of page 3, if I could just call your attention to the quote, more than a third of students deferred textbook purchases in the fall of 2010, according to a survey, including 10% of students sharing a textbook, 4 to 5% simply deciding not to buy one. Now, I got to tell you, as a professor, it would distress me to think that students were simply not buying the textbook, and I would ask them, how do you expect to succeed in the course if you don't have the book for the course? So I'm hoping that what we can do is address that issue, but I'll leave the rest of that to the next testifier.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Bannion, cost of higher education has gotten to the point that students can't afford to go to school. They can't afford to purchase their books. I certainly have that experience myself as a counselor at a community college. I understand that there are students that you know, are trying to find different ways of doing this. I'm just trying to figure out how this actually is going to help solve that problem. This doesn't put more money into the system.
No.
This doesn't reduce the cost by saying you're only going to rent books, for instance, or you're only going to have a different option and it's going to be a lower cost. This puts greater onus on the students, if I'm understanding it, to say you have to be better consumers. That on top of everything else, when the high cost of education is just, you know, it's stressful enough to say, okay, now you also need to take this on yourself. So, you know, I'm listening and trying to learn and understand what how this is going to be helpful. But that I certainly would say from a student's perspective, I'm sure they hope that the cost can be reduced. From a faculty member's perspective, I would say you also have to be as transparent and forthright as possible in order to continue to have students in your class. Because if you overprice your own class and textbooks, you're not going to have students.
Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Poppe, I agree. Or as economists will say, yes, demand curves slope downward. This is indeed a case where what we're trying to do is add to the information students have so that they have a greater chance to find alternative sources for the textbooks they have. If they wait to the last week or the last few days before they register for a class, I think what you'll see is they'll go to a default option, which tends to be fairly expensive. It's like deciding to buy all your groceries from the convenience store. Yes, it's convenient. Yes, you can buy them at the last minute, but doggone it, they're expensive. And this would give them an opportunity to basically shop, to look for a different place to acquire the books at a lower price. If you give folks more time and more information, it's pretty common to find that the price of those textbooks will go down because student choice will go to the lower cost options when they're available.
Yeah, I believe we'll move on to the next testifier. Thank you very much, Mr. Tested. Professor Tim Taylor. Is it snowing out yet? I
wasn't when I got
been indoors all day. I don't know. Just curious. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Timothy Taylor. I'm the managing editor of something called Journal of Economic Perspectives, which is an academic economics journal. I'm based here at McAllister College. In the very, very small world of academic economics, we're a relatively big fish. We're probably the most widely read academic journal of economics in the world. I also, perhaps more to the point here, I'm an award-winning teacher of introductory economics courses at the University of Minnesota, also at Stanford University, and I've written a textbook which is sold by an online publisher. Most intro textbooks these days for your intro micro, intro macro course will run about $200 these days, new. The idea of my book is that you can get a downloaded copy for $17. You can get an online copy. You get the online copy with a version you can download for $25, or you can get a paper printout of the book along with the online and stuff for $40. So I'm trying aggressively to undercut the market with only modest success. I passed around a little bit of a memo with some basic facts, but let me just hit the high spots on that, and then we can talk more about it if you like. First of all, there's a variety of survey evidence that students now are paying, on average, something like $1,000 a year for their textbooks. So that's a big number. That has been rising faster than inflation now for probably the last 20 years, two or three times as fast as inflation. So it's not just they're expensive, it's, as people were saying, it's going up very rapidly over time. This stresses students in a number of ways. One quantitative measure is that there was a report done for the Federal Department of Education in 2007, and by their calculation, at state colleges, the cost of textbooks was equal to 26% of the cost of tuition. And at community colleges, the cost of textbooks was equal to 70% of the cost of tuition. So we're not just talking about a small thing here. We're talking about something which fundamentally alters how people see the cost benefits of taking different courses. And then we've heard various discussion of how students drop classes, switch classes, use old books, share books, go without books. And as someone who teaches these classes, it's a terrible thing to sort of feel like you're trying to say, everyone read Chapter 3 for tomorrow, and you know a large percentage of the students don't have Chapter 3 or won't have access to it. This is not encouraging as you try and approach your lecture the next day. So what are people doing about this? This is, of course, a nationwide thing. In the handout, I offered a few quick examples of things that are happening around the country. One here at University of Minnesota, the College of Education and Human Development, in fall of 2010, they gave out free iPads to 450 incoming freshmen and then tried to make all the course materials digitally available. Now, it might sound like kind of a pricey thing to do. The iPads were all paid for by a foundation. But if you're thinking $1,000 per student per year through their college education, giving out the free iPads looks cheap. It's amazing that we've gotten to that point where free iPads is actually a cost-effective thing to do, if you can think of it that way. The California State University system recently signed a large agreement with a number of online content providers. That system has about 450,000 students, and they have about 5,000 digital textbooks up on that system now, and they negotiated hard to get free or low-cost prices on those textbooks. Their estimate is that their students will save about $100 million a year from being able to get their textbooks through that mechanism. Down at Rice University, with the funding from the Gates Foundation and some other groups, they're writing free textbooks which are going to be written and then will be freely available to anyone from any university online. And they've written textbooks so far, I believe, for physics and sociology, and they have some biology textbooks and anatomy physiology books coming. Their estimate is for these five books, if these five books could get 10% of the national market, that would save students $90 million a year. State of Washington has an ongoing thing for their community college system where they've set up an online digital library with the books for the 40 most popular courses offered through the community college system. Their idea is the books should all be digitally available for free, or if you have a printout copy, it should be no more than $30. They're planning to add another 40 books to that this year. I'm sure there are many other examples. These are just ones that happened to run across my desk in the last couple of weeks. But I'm trying to give you a sense that there's a lot of action happening out there, a lot of motion in this area, and there's a lot of possibilities for things that would go beyond the scope of this bill, which I view as a useful first step, but really just a very first step. So let me just sum up here by saying, some of you I know around the room teach college classes, but let me just say, for the sake of clarifying what's going on here, how does a traditional textbook market work? There are four really big publishers out there in the U.S., and there's a bunch of faculty members. And the publishers come to the faculty members and knock on your door. And if you're teaching, say, a big intro course at the University of Minnesota, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of students, they can calculate for an economics class that if you can get 500 students to pay $200 a piece for their book, that's $100,000 in sales for that one course, that one time. So those textbook people knock on your door a lot. And they take you to lunch, and they offer you a few hundred dollars to review textbook chapters, and they generally try and be your best bud. They tell you how wise and smart you are a lot. Never gets old. But they also, along with that, they do offer packages with these books. And so the package is not just the textbook, but it's course support materials. It's PowerPoints, it's lecture notes, it's study guides, it's online quizzes, online tests, grading for all of those things, well-tested study banks. And if you are a teacher who has hundreds and hundreds of students, that kind of course support can really be kind of a lifesaver. So where you are as a professor is, the students are going to pay for the book one way or another, and so you sort of think to yourself, well, if I can give them a better course and I can get all this support material, then that makes sense for me to do it. And so what these companies do is they don't compete on holding down the price. They compete, sort of like the airlines used to many years ago, on providing lots of frills and extra stuff. And so the competition isn't price competition. It's competition in providing add-ons. And that's, according to various government studies, that's what's really been driving up the price substantially over the last 10 or 15 years. So, in a way, you could even say that colleges and universities encourage this, because when you give professors tons and tons of students and not a lot of administrative support, they turn to try and get that support somewhere else. And the textbook publishers are one way of getting some of that support for themselves. So the bottom line in all this, I think, is that this market where publishers market to faculty and faculty get students to buy the books has been too cozy. And we've seen in the last 20 years or so the effects of that in terms of high prices and rising prices. And so I think that the time has come in a lot of places around the country to try and have someone step into that market and either provide more information so that it's not quite as opaque as it is. I mean, isn't it in a way just remarkable that as a student you can't figure out what the price of a book is? You can't figure out what the price of a substitute book is? I mean, in general, markets don't work well and people don't have information about stuff. But then in addition to that, I would encourage the committee and the legislature to think about some of these other models that are out there now. There's a lot of free content available now in the world. A lot of it's pretty cruddy, truth be told, and there's problems of assuring quality, and there's problems of making sure it's all well linked together so that faculty have the linked together materials they need. But there's a lot of models for getting that out there. So in general, I would encourage the legislature and, you know, with a little push from the students and a push from the universities, not just to let publishers and faculty make this decision, but to push into that space a little bit. I'm open for questions.
Okay, thank you. Members, we have two more testifiers. We need to move along here. Is that okay? Okay. Thank you very much, Professor.
Pleasure.
Bryce Hildebrand. We also need to send our recommendations on bonding to someplace before we're done. Mr. Hildebrand, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Bruce Hildebrand. I'm Executive Director of Higher Education, the American Association of Publishers in Washington, D.C. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you to Representative Banyan, who had the opportunity to speak with at some length yesterday. Before beginning specifically addressing 223, I will try to be very brief, Mr. Chairman, because I know you're running out of rope here. First thing you need to know is we actually very much share the desire for greater transparency. My members, my association, and I personally work very hard on the Higher Education Opportunity Act because transparency, we can put it in noble terms, but the reality, sir, it's very good for my members and for students and for faculty, and those are the three that have to be satisfied, so we want to get as much information out as fast as we humanly can. I provided each of you with a brochure. I just want you to please see this and recognize that I created this operation with my members, and it's called the Cost-Effective Solutions for Student Success Program. We go all across the country actually teaching faculty, chief academic officers, provost, faculty, whomever, within the academic community, ways to accomplish three goals, which is to improve your retention and completion rates of students, lower your costs for instructions for the school, and cut costs for the students. In fact, week before last, I was in San Antonio, Texas, participating in the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, which is made up of provosts and chief academic officers. And it's not something new to us. It's something we're extending. I keep hearing people talking about that students can't get information. So I went to some very good resources and found out that, in fact, 61% of students now, and that's grown 3% in the last semester from 58%, now shop online before they acquire their textbooks. And so what I did, I have a textbook here. I put its psychology. It's one of the most popular books of its kind in the world. I put its ISBN number into my iPad, and in one-tenth of a second, I got 436 different people willing to sell me that textbook in 17 different formats at prices ranging from $57.75 to $132.98. Now, we know that 61% of students do go online to shop. We know that 26% of students, they don't care what it costs. They just want the most convenient way to get it. They, like so many of our children, are used to mom and dad paying for their textbooks, obviously. And then there's 17% of students that are tied because of they get money from the different financial aid that are tied to the bookstore. So I think it's very few students who do not know that they can shop. I also want you to be aware of all, since I testified before this committee in 2008, there's been a world change. The amount of technology that's in the marketplace and its impact has been documented to death. You can lower the cost to the school and to the students by 30% to 40%, and you can increase their pass rates by 30% to 40% with the use of publisher-produced technology. And I think that's sort of critical. And last but not least, before we hit the bill, please be aware that the amount of money students actually spend has been flat or in decline since 2006. I'm not going to go through all of the options that are available. Just tell you that I just wrote down 9 here just for quick choices. I won't even enumerate them. I'll be happy to discuss them. We spoke about them yesterday. But the spending is flat, and it's because of technology. It's because of e-books. It's because of rentals of all ilk. It's because you could, did you know, I'm 64. I never would have thought of this. Remember when you bought 3 textbooks because the faculty told you to, and they had 100 chapters in all of them, and you only used 10 of them total, and you felt like you didn't get a good return on your investment? Well, now you can go online and buy your chapters one at a time, and as low as $1.99 when you need it. So the choices are exploding, and the prices are going down. So please be aware of that, and the students know it, and they're shopping it. Now, in terms of this bill, you're very aware, I'm sure, of the 3 studies. I participated in a number of them. I got to know Minneapolis much better than I thought I ever would. You're aware of the Federal Higher Education Opportunity Act. The one thing that has not been mentioned in here is that you already have a website at MSKU that's called the Textbook Project. You have the Minnesota Learning Commons. You have the MSKU Affordable Learning Solutions Initiative. You have the MSKU Textbook Pilot Project. So in terms of a study group or working group, you have numerous vehicles that already exist that are already linked to websites, teams of people, and all that. And that might be an avenue that you could avail yourself of if you would be if you would find it interesting. In terms of the bill per se, I understand what the goal is. We discussed a couple of technical problems yesterday. For example, it says that you would print the materials at 1.20 in a hard copy format. Please understand there's more than 264,000 textbook titles currently in your system. And to try to print out all those, a large school might, particularly one with a medical school, a law school, whatever, might have 100,000 titles. And they change constantly. And to try to print those in a hard copy would and be effective, it would be a huge cost and incredibly burdensome and not very effective. We discussed that. I really don't think that's feasible. The term shell instead of comply as best you can and give it out is going to be very, very difficult. You're changing courses all the time. You're hiring faculty at the last minute. You're adding new sections. The word shell is awfully overbearing as a requirement. You're talking about, how many of your custom textbooks, it says including textbook custom textbooks, we find that positive. Custom textbooks is the fastest growing section of the publishing industry right now in higher ed. It talks about 3 previous copyright dates. That was in the Higher Education Opportunity Act, which I was involved with. That was to inform the faculty. All you're going to do is confuse the students, we fear, and they're going to come to the textbook, and like the class with the wrong textbook, as that young man described earlier. I would not go further except to say you talk about stopping handing out or stop limiting bundling. Bundling has been the greatest success story in improving students' pass rates. And lowering prices. I don't think you want to do that because 75% of your faculty are now ordering bundles. And I think you don't even have to look at the expansion of e-books. I got 3.4 million hits in 0.19 seconds when I entered that in Google. And I can show you 100 different ways to buy them right now. Any questions, sir?
Sure, Hildebrand. We do have questions.
Thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Yeah. Any questions, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, I'm more committed now to your project than ever. Mr. Representative Banyan, you mentioned the bundling. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you were a department chair. I think you also mentioned the federal law has addressed the bundling issue, as did we. Representative Bannon, I went to a book that I assign every year. I've got it right in front of me. I'm on its website. I'm chagrined in part because I'm one of the people who's on the blurb on the back saying that you should use this book in your course. I know this book. I want to tell you, Representative Bannon, what it tells you about the revisions on this book. Here's what the website says. Reflects the most recent case law, reflects current developments, updates discussion. Now, if you were a student trying to figure out whether this was a meaningful difference between the current edition and the previous edition, you probably don't have very much information to go by. Representative Bannon, I think we've got to look at this, as I said before, and I mentioned this to you yesterday, sir, when you were in my office. Representative Bannon and Chair Norris, I do think we have to look at the open access, the digital, the electronic. We have experts here from the University of Minnesota and MNSCU who can help guide us on task force, working group, and the like. And, Mr. Chair, I think we're going to have to, we should talk as a committee about having an informational hearing, at least, still this session, on open educational resources and digital electronic textbooks.
All right. Good suggestion. Mr. Hildebrand, I think
we're
probably ready to move on to the next testifier, since
I
see no questions for you.
Time.
So, okay. And we have Don Larson. Again, you need to be as brief as possible.
I'll do my best. Thank you, Chair Nornes, Representative Bannon, and representatives for this opportunity. My name is Donald F. Larson. I'm a professor at Minnesota State University, Mankato, but I'm here in my capacity as the president of the interfaculty organization representing the faculty members of the seven state universities. I wanted to address the overarching issue of the aim of Representative Bannon's suggested changes in the legislation and the students' desire for more open access to information about textbook pricing. I can say that the IFO and the faculty in general support those goals unequivocally. We do have problems with the way in which certain aspects of this bill as currently drafted lay them out. To summarize very quickly, I would say that, first of all, in relation to the specific kinds of language changes that are in this current draft for the legislation itself, we think that those changes are premature. That I think both Professor Taylor and Mr. Hildebrand both suggested the range of complexities of a very quickly changing environment. It's changing in terms economically, in academically, and technologically in relation to textbooks. And I think trying to pin down minute details of specific elements of textbook use and pricing in a piece of legislation that's meant to last for a fair amount of time is something of a futile effort. On the other hand, we do think that the notion of the task force to engage in and look further at examples of best practices, types of recommendations, ways of cost savings that could be found, encouraged, enhanced, and built upon is a really good idea. And I really appreciate Representative Bannon's openness to deferring the specific language here about his task force to the work group that Amanda Bardner and the students mentioned in their testimony that's already in progress at MNSCU. The IFO, in collaboration with the students, the administration, and the other bargaining units, more than a year ago, began an exhaustive process of trying to reform the committee structures within the MNSCU system office. As you know, MNSCU, like many organizations of its kind, has many, many committees that involve shareholders, stakeholders, constituents, whatever, of many kinds. And it was an amazing number of committees whose purposes were often at clear, sometimes at odds with each other. And that process has been drastically streamlined through our mutual efforts. I think this is an ideal opportunity to use this very topic and to run this through our new structure. Just to summarize real quickly, that structure involves four overarching councils within the Academic and Student Affairs Division of MNSCU. One on academic affairs, one on student affairs, one on academic technology, and one on academic policy. This topic of books and course materials touches on all four of those committees. So we have structures in place that won't require us to try to figure out what kind of a new task force or work group we need to create, who will we appoint to that, what will their charge be. That information's already out there, ready to be operationalized, shovel ready, if you will. So I'd like to see that advance that way. Let me just conclude by offering a couple additional twists on some of the information provided previously by Professor Taylor and Mr. Hildebrand. One of the things that I don't see the current draft language addressing at all is recognition of the kinds of efforts that are already underway and in place on many of our campuses. Mr. Hildebrand mentioned the Minsky textbook pilot project, which you may recall was actually funded by the legislature a couple of years ago. And at Mankato, my home campus, I was in on discussions with administration, the bookstore, and students in creating a project that was funded by that, and it's been quite successful. This is a textbook reserve system where faculty members can put their textbooks on reserve in the library, and students can then check them out for limited periods of time. It's been very successful. A number of our faculty members are very pleased with it. I think the students are obviously very pleased with it as well. I'd also point out that in relation to Professor Taylor's testimony, right now, within the seven state universities, two of the bookstores are freestanding, owned by the universities. That's Winona and Moorhead. Two of them are owned by Barnes & Noble. That's Mankato and Southwest, and the other three by Follett, one of the other two or three big providers in this area, and that's Bemidji Metro and St. Cloud. Out of those seven campuses, six now have textbook rental systems in place. Some are more limited than others, but they're in place on six of those seven campuses, or soon to be coming soon. I believe five of them are actually operational now. Winona announces that it should be up and running this spring. Moorhead seems to be the one that does not yet have that in place. In addition, if you chance to look at the Mankato Free Press just yesterday, they ran an article about an independent bookstore in town, the Maverick Bookstore, which has an even more expansive rental policy as well, and that's been quite successful too. My final point then returns to the beginning, that this is a rapidly changing environment with many different facets, commercially, academically, and technologically. We should not try at this point to nail down something that is moving so quickly, but we should understand what we're working with and have a response that will actually be of use to the students. And I'll stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you. I don't see any questions, so thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify before we we're running out of time, so if you can keep this down to just a couple of minutes, we'd sure appreciate that. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Yes, my name is Rick Heller. I currently unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional and the Print Disabled. Print Disability is found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act 2008. As you know, that's a non-entitlement group next to the blind group. There was a reason why they were placed in there, including Universal Design for Learning was defined in that act. And Universal Design for Learning wasn't necessarily using technology, however, if technology is one of the elements that you use, more for the learners. I provided this handout before to the representative here, and it's from the National Center of Learning Disabilities on page 9. It talks about marketing-based approaches, which is basically what this flyer is all about. And it's a windfall, as you know, for these publishers now. And because we're finally tapping into the how of learning regarding learners. And by the way, Universal Design defined three elements, the what, how, and why of learning. And it's time that I'm glad to hear that we're turning the page on looking at how learners learn. It's also called learning preferences or learning styles. I'm glad to hear that that we're looking at it at the top end. However, it's important also that the state also looks at the low end for self-advocacy skills for learners, that they know early on what their learning preferences are so they can be engaged and motivated in a more meaningful way. I appreciate the extra time in this bill for individuals to review these documents, because they need to know internally, or they're born with their internal intrinsic way of learning, and it's important that they have extra time to review that information, because if it doesn't fit, and that may include the teaching styles of the professor, then perhaps you want to go somewhere else. Again, if you can't get the engagement, you're going to have a poor outcome. And as you know, the Higher Education Opportunity Act is to provide that to learners' potential. And the twice exceptional learners, as you know, are really quite unrepresented in the state of Minnesota and unidentified. However, I believe it's a very large group. It's unfortunate at this point. I don't hear much of that up here. And yet we know that even colleges and universities are accepting these individuals on piloted programs, but I don't frankly hear that going on. But once again, I appreciate the time to speak here tonight. There's one thing I do want to finalize on is when we talk about measuring costs for books, and yet that's all I see in here. We all know that they're born digital. Yet where's the linkage when it comes to the technology component and their platforms? As you know, universal design is all about flexibility to meet the individual needs of each unique learner. As you know, these tools in this handout, this is kind of the tool manual. They claim in there that one of the metrics they use for being competitive, and I don't know if you want to use this part of the task force, is they get half letter grades, that's their quotes, or 10% higher scores on the exams. Those are just suggestions. I do promote that there should be a round table to talk about technology, universal design, including the twice exceptional and print disabled learners. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. Members, any other questions? I don't see any. So Representative Bandian, would you have a final comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to get another bite at the apple here as we contemplate putting this to an omnibus. I don't know that we need to do much more, but I thank you for the discussion. I thank all the folks testifying. I thank Mr. Hildebrand for flying in to visit with us, because I thought his comments were helpful too, and I look forward to working with you and with you, Representative Morrow, on aspects of this bill as it moves forward.
Chair, lay House File 2213 then over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Final item of business, each of you should have a copy of a letter that was written addressed to Representative and Chairman Howes dealing with bonding. Any comments? Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for making the letter available. I appreciate that you did that and you took this extra time. Mr. Chair, I feel like I'm stuck at a crossroads here, so I'm just going to try to make it quick. I would ask that we delete the last sentence concerning the governor's recommendation, unless we're willing to put in the amount that we think is sufficient. And if we're going to keep in that sentence, then, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have suggested additions concerning the special session HEPR money and other bonding money that the governor did approve. So my first suggestion is just take out the sentence. If we can't take out the sentence, then I'm going to ask that we make different changes.
I think the intention was to pass along the message that that it's insufficient. If you want to take out the reference to the governor, I don't necessarily see that's a big deal either way, but I don't know how members feel if it's...
Could you just take out, just take the governor out of there?
Is that
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm trying not to bypass you here. I hear you both saying, and I could pretty much go there, except I don't know what, if I'm the Capital Investments Committee, all I know is what's insufficient. I don't know what is sufficient. So I don't know why we need that last sentence unless we're willing to say this is what we think is sufficient.
Yeah. it maybe isn't clear, but I think what we were looking for was as close to the recommendation that came from the two systems as possible. But it, you know, that's just an interpretation that I guess that's what we were hoping for.
Mr. Chair, then I would say put in the two numbers the two systems requested if you want to do that. I'm not trying to really make it difficult. I would just take out the last sentence, and then the committee can decide what's sufficient.
It's somewhat immaterial because the committee will put in whatever number they choose in the end anyway. So it's we can do it either way. You want to make a formal motion that you delete that last line?
I'll make that a formal motion.
Members? All those in favor of deleting? It's to delete the last line in our recommendation?
Okay.
Any discussion?
No.
Okay. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. It's done. All right. With that in mind, are we ready? Yes, Representative Banyan.
If I understood what we just tried to do, do you want to say something about the two systems request at the end of the previous sentence, or are you, what's the committee's feeling? It sounded like we wanted to say something stronger rather than just dropping that sentence.
Well, the line that we now have is the last line indicates the committee recommends a significant investment.
If we included the words equal to the systems, apostrophe after the S, request, would that be more reflective of the will of this committee?
Representative Benson.
I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far, but I think that we need to add a line that does emphasize that we believe a significant investment in HEPR is critical. Maybe just leaving it a little bit more open-ended, but emphasizing the fact that HEPR needs to be, you know, a big portion of whatever is finally recognized.
Well, the line currently says significant investment, so it's up to how specific you want to.
Mr. Chairman, significant investment seems to me to be where we want to go.
It's not saying little investment, it's significant. So I think I think the message is clear as we can, and again, the committee will make that, the Capital Investment Committee will make the final decision. So I'd like to then renew my original motion from our last meeting, which takes into the language that's on that letter, forwarding to the Higher Education Committee the 2012 capital request for the University of Minnesota and the State College and University System. Following recommendations that the Higher Education Committee recommends funding of these requests at the highest possible amount possible in the order of priority established by the Board of Regents and the Board of Trustees. And in regard to the Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement Funding, the committee recommends a significant investment. If that meets your approval, and we probably should act on that motion, and all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Good deal. And with that, members, I believe we're done for the day.